Hi there. Thank you for listening to the Life's Work podcast. I hope that you're enjoying the music and the stories being shared, and I hope especially that you're enjoying the chance to listen to Laura tell all these stories herself. Because not only is she one of the greatest living songwriters of our time, but just listening to her talk is such a thrill. She is one of the funniest, most intelligent, and charming people that I've ever listened to. And through this podcast, we're learning about the dedication that she has to songwriting. And we can see her honesty, her compassion, humility, and a boundless sense of creative energy that she's spent her entire life putting into her work and sharing it with us. On Monday, Laura announced the launch of her Patreon, which you can check out over at patreon.com/Laura Stevenson. Patreon is a way for you to directly support the lives of creatives by pledging a monthly amount in exchange for Patreon-exclusive things, which in the case of someone like Laura Stevenson means new or previously unreleased music, video updates, handwritten lyric sheets, sticker sheets, enamel pins, even free guest list spots at future shows, and Patreon-exclusive merchandise and vinyl variants. Now, if you have all of Laura's records already, this is a chance for you to hear even more from her. And if you love Laura's music and listen to her songs on streaming services, this is a chance for you to say thanks for the ones she shared and to provide her with the means to create more for us. Monthly pledging starts at $5 a month. To sign up or get more details, head on over to patreon.com/Laura Stevenson. And now for your regularly scheduled programming. This is Laura Stevenson, a songwriter and singer from Long Island, New York. She learned to sing from her grandmother, Margaret McCravey, who sang professionally with Benny Goodman's band.
I was so into like standards and stuff because of my grandma, because she sang with Benny Goodman. So like we just had all that old music. Just all those beautiful old songs, which I've now been singing to my daughter. I mean, and also like her story, you know, she came up in South Carolina and she built her career and ended up in New York City. And that's where she met my grandfather. You know, it was really inspiring. And actually the song Red Clay Roots, I wrote after I found her memoirs, which she never finished, which she was going to call Red Clay Roots. And I read it all in one night and it was like so beautiful. And I tried to write a song that sounded like she would have written it, like coming from that era.
Red Clay Roots is the first song on the second side of Laura Stevenson's second album, Sit Resist. Sit Resist was released by Don Giovanni Records on April 26, 2011, and it has been remastered at Abbey Road Studios as part of a special deluxe reissue to be released on September 4th, 2020. Life's Work is a podcast about Sit Resist, the story of a songwriter whose roots are planted deep in the soil, and a singer whose voice blossomed nourishing life for those who stop to listen. I'm Tim Christopher, better yet, and this is Life's Work. Laura's grandmother and her grandfather, Harry Simeone, were part of New York music before rock and roll. While her grandmother came from the Southeast, her grandfather's career started in Newark, New Jersey.
He lived in Newark and he was really good at the piano. And so he started playing in silent movie houses. And then somebody gave him the opportunity to go to Juilliard. And then he started working for CBS and he, you know, they both kind of like built their careers, which is really cool. And then they met there. And my grandfather also is like just really interesting vocal arranger, you know? And so I think like that to me was really inspiring for like all the layered shit that I do. I can definitely hear a lot of stuff. Like also he's like weird and super into like dissonant, just kind of like avant-garde sort of music.
You may not know the name Harry Simeone, but trust me, you've heard his arrangements.
You know, like Christmas music, like The Little Drummer Boy and Do You Hear What I Hear, which are the two things he's most famous for, his chorale's version of them, which are like kind of the main version. When you think of those songs and you hear it in your head, you're like, oh yeah, that's my grandfather. And just like all of the there's a lot of dissonance there, and there's a lot of just experimental weird shit. And he was a weirdo, and he was super talented and super driven. They both were. They're like amazing piano players. And I mean, that was like super inspiring to be in the same family as them. Hopefully some of it trickled down, but I never really wanted to express any of my musical talents in front of them because I was afraid that I would get critiqued too hard.
Laura's grandparents provided a foundation for her writing that predates modern pop music. Have you ever noticed that there isn't a song on Sit Resist that has a chorus in it? Well, don't even get her started on bridges.
I hate an unnecessary bridge. It's like, what are we doing? We're just wasting everybody's time. Like, if you really want to go back to the chorus, do it. And if you feel like you need to put some bullshit in there just to get another chorus out of it, the song should just be over. So that's basically how I feel about songs.
Like most hot takes coming from Don Giovanni Records in the year 2020, she kind of has a point. And she's got history to back her up.
The standards that my grandma used to sing with Benny Goodman, we had a whole CD of all the songs that she used to sing. And it would just be two verses and then she's out, you know, like, or a verse, a chorus, another verse, and then she's out. And then the band just repeats the melody. And then, you know, so like they do an intro that's like 2 minutes long. The vocals and the meat of the song comes in very briefly, and then there's like a beautiful repetition instrumentally, and then there's an outro, and then that's it. And so I think that those are the most perfect songs because they're concise. At least like the ideas are, you know, they get repeated, but it's different sections and it's not, you know, but I'd say like the bulk of the song is when she's like singing.
Laura was taking cues from the old world, but when she made a record, she discovered electricity.
I think the first time I ever played an electric guitar ever was recording the song The Source and the Sound on a record. That was the first time I had ever like held an electric guitar. I'd never played one before. So, you know, I was not... It seemed really scary to me, but the electric guitar actually opened up so many doors for me. And even though I was still kind of like sticking with finger picking for the most part, it created this whole like dynamic range. I could like paint with it instead of just like using it to accompany me and like be the melody. Even like on a record, I would try to do melodies, but like a lot of times I would pluck the wrong strings and then just be like, whatever. But, you know, I started trying to be more precise because the electric guitar is a little bit less forgiving and louder and more in your face. And so I think it was the introduction of the electric guitar in my life that really like kind of shaped the way that that record sounded and shaped me as a guitar player.
Laura started playing with her friend Alex Billig around the same time she started playing with her partner and bass player, Mike Campbell.
Alex Billig, I met through Laura soon after Laura and I met. He lived down the block from me in Clinton Hill. It was just sort of happenstance that all of us occupied the same like 6-block radius in Brooklyn. And it's wild. But Alex went to Boston University, where Laura met him because Laura's sister was going to Boston University. And they actually all went to college with Joe Steinhardt as well, who runs Don Giovanni.
I'd met Alex previously. He was friends with my ex-boyfriend. And so I kind of just hung on to him after the breakup because I just liked him so much. And I was really glad that he still wanted to be my friend because he is one of the best people I've ever met. And he's one of my best friends to this day. Super generous, super genuine, super hilarious, total freak. And I love him dearly. And if I told him that, he would be totally freaked out.
So Alex was playing in a few bands in Brooklyn. And Alex was always sort of like utility player. Like he played, you know, Irish tin whistle. He played a trumpet. He played what he ended up playing most, especially in this period, was the accordion. And then eventually he started playing like a Nord 3 keyboard. So he was always sort of the aux utility player. So yeah, that was sort of like the early core of the band. We would play shows as a three-piece like that all the time, where it would be me on bass or acoustic guitar, Laura on guitar, Alex on several different either brass or wind instruments, sort of switching from song to song.
The three together would form a solid shape, with Laura's songs at the center. But with each new song coming in, the scope started to change.
It felt like, and even from talking with Alex in and around this time, that we knew that Laura's songs were so good that it was this thing that we almost were like, let's do any and everything we can do to make this as serious and take this as seriously as we all should be.
Words like serious, words like ambition, can go a few different ways. But in the case of Laura Stevenson, ambition only registers when it comes to making music. And when it comes to the songs that would make Upset Resist, there was no end goal, there was no career path, there was just songs. Big songs. Serious songs.
These songs needed more, and that's why we gave it more. You know what I mean? Like, because the songs were just more mature and complex, you know? Like, I felt like the songs themselves were just larger than me. And I felt like they were better than the last batch of songs. So they just needed more care and more energy and, I guess now, looking back on it, more people.
So they started having practices at Alex's, just two blocks down the street from Mike. Friends would show up and work on songs. One of those people was Jeff Rosenstock, who always seems to have a way of making something feel large and important, but also just sort of regular.
Yeah, I think Laura was hearing these parts in her heads, and she just had, like, between me and Alex and Wenjay and Matt Keegan, like, she had a string section, an accordion person. Oh, and fucking Aiden. Like, she had a string section on call. She had a horn section on call. She had somebody playing accordion throughout everything, which is one of the most interesting things about these early records, is that they're, like, laced with this droney accordion in a way that I think is really cool and unique and unlike other things. And she could just be like, hey, I want a thing to be like, ba-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da. And we'd just be like, okay. And me and, like, Keegan and Alex would figure out how to play it as a trio. It was just like, it was cool. But then also, I think it's so funny because looking back on all this, I never, like, realized, like, what a fucking ripping guitar player Laura was, because she undersells herself. But, like, she was just, like, playing this, like, cool, finger-picky, not really like anybody else stuff. Ed had all these ancillary players who I was part of, and then you had Chris Parker, who's an amazing drummer, Mike Campbell, who's one of the best bass players I know. It was cool. It was cool. Well, I don't think any of us realized, like, oh man, everybody in this room is a fucking shredder. We were all just like, hey, I brought you a tall boy. Alex, are your roommates cool with us playing this late?
And I think it was a matter of, let's invite as much onto this as we think could help the process of arranging and adding to the songs, and invite as much into it as we can, almost to get, like, broad brush strokes, and then whittle away at it, you know? So just sort of start with as much as you could possibly need and then take away from there. And I think, you know, the fact that there's a musical saw for maybe 13 seconds on the record. Anne-Marie, you know, came to practices with her musical saw, but Anne-Marie, you hear her musical saw for about, you know, like I said, like 14 seconds, but it was very much like, man, a musical saw would be so cool on this record. Let's try to put it everywhere. And then it was like, no, that's wild. Let's not put a musical saw everywhere. But so it was where it needed to be on the record, you know? And I think the inverse of that is maybe Alex's accordion playing, where Alex's accordion is omnipresent in the record, almost as like a dull roar or a pad, like a low end pad. You know, that's an example of the inverse of that, where it's like, actually this as a tone is really adding a lot to the overall sound. So it should be present as, you know, as much as it is.
At first it was just like any place that it felt like it needed to get a little bit bigger or like a little bit more full, he would just play low chords, like with his left hand. He wasn't doing a lot of, like, only the places where it really seemed necessary, where there was a lead, he would play, you know, on the key side. And so I feel like we just really liked the way that it filled in that space. So Alex would just kind of like provide that layer, you know, between the bass and where the guitars start. So that felt full on the bottom. And then when I wasn't singing and there was like a lead that was like specific, he could play it on the key side. And it was just like such a versatile instrument for this band. And it just became like his main instrument. And then now he has like three accordions. But at first he just had this like little like trebly little red accordion. And then he just kept graduating to like bigger and better accordions. So it was like, it was cool. Just kind of watching that evolve for him.
And, you know, banjo. There's banjo on one song, but Steve D'Agostino would play shows and he would just play the banjo the entire set as if it were a rhythm guitar. You know, so it was just this period of time where everyone was sort of treating it like a collective insofar as there could be nine people on stage. But then, you know, taking that broad brushstroke and then maybe whittling it down when it's coming to put the record together, where it's like, where actually does it make sense to have a banjo ripping? Maybe only here. Where does it make sense to have the glockenspiel? Maybe just here, you know? But having all those people contributing and putting in pieces, whether large or small, I think really added to the overall record and the vibe and the feel of it.
You know, it was never really my project, even though it was like my songs. It was never like, I never was like, this is my vision, like, get the fuck out. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody was around and wanted to play, it would be, sometimes it would be like making room for parts and stuff. And like, it ended up being very cool because we're all creative people and we're not just like throwing random shit in there and hoping it'll be good. You know, like, everybody's like, you know, really smart and good at what they do. But then other times it was like a very clear idea that I was like, okay, I know I have this melodic idea. I don't know what instrument it's going to be good on, but like, if, you know, when Jay's here today and she's playing the violin, you know, like, sick, this is a string part, you know what I mean? Or like Jeff's around, he has his saxophone today, you know, like that's like Barnacles was the horns kind of like built themselves from just them being available. Every time we got together, we would just like make the song better and then make a recording of that and make the song even better and make a recording of that. And then once we had enough of those, we were like, oh shit, we should like put this down and like make it a real record.
And I mean, that time there wasn't really any, there wasn't music coming out of the punk DIY adjacent scene. There wasn't any music that sounded like the music Laura was making at that time. And I think since then, there's been a lot more of it. But I mean, maybe it just took people time to figure that out.
And so we just had time to practice, you know, and we had the energy to just like work. And it didn't seem like practice. We were just like working on the songs. And I was always like trying to be super democratic and like, even if something wasn't like my like number one choice for an idea, like I would just be like, okay, let's see how we can make this work, because I wanted people to feel, you know, fulfilled. And then that's how you learn how to play with people. So it was cool to like have a group of people and like us all feel like we're contributing, you know what I mean? And like, even though something isn't my, it wouldn't be like my first choice is what I'm saying about some of like the choices that got made, but then like you learn to love it because it's somebody else's idea and it's better than what you would have thought, you know, if you just open up your mind. So it makes you a better musician, and just like a better person probably.
We began this week in the Carolinas. So let's go back to the southeast, to Richmond, Virginia, the hometown of songwriter and singer Lucy Dacus, whose second album, Historian, along with her work as a member of the three-piece band Boy Genius, have established her as one of the most promising talents in indie rock.
So do you remember the first time you heard Laura's music?
Yeah, my friend in high school took it upon himself to educate me because I was like this suburban lady who wanted to know about more culture, but I basically just had like Christian rock and top 40 in my vicinity. And there was one day that he brought over a record by Laura, and we put it on the record player and laid on the floor and listened to it and didn't talk, flipped it, listened to the other side, didn't talk. And that was the entire hangout. Was like, we're not discussing this, just get ready. And I still try to listen to music like that. Like, I feel like because I listen to it that way, it has never left me. Like, I was as like the most open as I was to be changed by something in that scenario. And it totally did. Like, I feel like I remember so many moments from that record as like formative sonic moments in my brain.
But it wasn't very much blood, so they didn't give me much money. They didn't give me much.
My dad's record player was in our office, which was really cramped and basically just had a desk and a computer and a record player. And we laid down on the floor on like the nasty suburban carpet that was in there that has the texture of like itchy oatmeal. There was like a window and the sun was going down, and I remember hearing a shine to it and just realizing that I couldn't really see stuff anymore. I felt kind of like it didn't matter. Like I didn't notice it happening because I was paying so much attention to the music that like basically my other senses were just like not really mattering. Like it was just all hearing and listening. Time tracking my influences just because I wasn't trying to make music at the beginning, so I wasn't actively trying to learn from anyone. But hearing Laura's music made me feel like, oh, I could do that possibly. It's very approachable. I felt like I could understand sonically where everything was coming from. I feel like I had maybe thoughts and images similar to the ones that she was expressing. And she also doesn't really pay attention to form. And I loved that because it made me feel like I didn't need to know about like verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, or whatever people do. Like it seemed very like genuine and of her. And yeah, I think that she was probably the person I listened to before I like really went and decided to write some songs.
There was something that you said before that I really liked about the simplicity of it. And I think that what's a really great expression in Laura's music is that it takes time to make itself that simple. So what appears simple is only appears that way because the message is so sharpened and it's so clear.
Yeah, I was thinking about how there's not necessarily catchy elements in the way that like a song on the radio is catchy, but there are images that have caught me that I like cannot forget. Like on Sit Resist, a couple are like the line about I'll hang up my hands when I'm done. Just that image has never left me. And also the verse about the TV falling from the second story window, that those two things, like, I feel like they're literally something that I've seen because of the way that she wrote them and also how they're positioned in the arrangements. You know, like she'll have these like big bombastic parts with lots of instruments, and then they'll shrink again and be like, come closer, we're going inward, quiet yourself, pay attention. Like it's very effective. I think maybe it's in Peachy, where it starts off kind of like as a upbeat bop, meanwhile, she's saying, like, I can't be the reason you're alive. Like, it's this really hard thing that you have to tell somebody. Yeah. Yeah, it does seem like she's offering you these scenes from her life. It's like she'll be saying something and you can just tell that it's hard for her to say. And it's that much more of a gift. Like just hearing her voice waver in a moment, like you can kind of feel it in your own throat. Like that wavering feeling of like, uh-oh, what's she about to say? What am I about to hear? And that's why I feel like an emotional connection to it, is because like if you follow her through what she's sharing and how she's sharing it, it's just, it feels really generous. And also all the quiet moments, again, the going from really like confident and loud and bombastic to the quiet moments, that's one of like the main things I think I learned from her, is just trading off moods, I guess, and going between them, because that's also what life feels like. Sometimes you're confident or you're angry, you're able to be loud, and other times it takes whispering in order to be able to say anything.
I am small, the television swirling from the second floor. My sister's ending night as we watch it go. Another scene with sirens in the front yard for the neighbors to read by the lights of.
And the end is that lyric about the TV falling from the window, and how like that image acts as sort of like a explanation for the first half of the song, at least in my head. It's basically like, here's what I've come to, and then just so you know, here's where I'm coming from. And that wasn't just a lesson in songwriting. I feel like that was a lesson that I needed to hear as a friend too. And I mean, that's what all the best songwriting is like, you don't just listen to it because in a vacuum, it's a really good song. If it affects you, it's because it changes your actual thoughts and life and maybe how you approach relationships and yourself. And yeah, that song, I think, like, did a lot of helpful processing for me.
Well, that is a very specific moment where it was like one of my earliest memories when I was little, where my sister took me out of the house and we were standing in the yard or we were sitting in the front yard because my dad was inside fighting with my mom, and my dad was not allowed in the house because there was an order of protection. So he would like violate it and then the cops would come. So that was like what always happened at my house. So we were the weird house on the block where like the cops were always at our house, you know, and we lived in like a pretty sleepy town. So it was embarrassing later on in life. But like earlier on, I didn't really understand. But one of my earliest memories is my sister like taking me outside and holding my hand. And then we saw the TV got thrown out the window because my dad wanted the TV. So that was like the fight was over this like TV. And then my mom wouldn't give it to him. And then he threw it out the window, I guess, because it was like, but then like, he's not getting the TV, but nobody has the TV. You know what I mean? But yeah, so like that was a very specific, like visceral visual that I have where it's like, yeah. And my sister was just like taking care of me, you know, because she was like the older sister. So it was nice.
I feel like she just respects music, which honestly, a lot of musicians don't. And I don't even know if I do as much as her. Like, I think she just respects songwriting and her own, like, I guess, like what's at the core of what she's doing. Like, she's always remembering that.
And the funny thing is, even though that happened, I love TV. Can't get enough of this stuff. You name a show, I'll watch it.
Life's Work is a production of Don Giovanni Records and Better Yet. To pre-order the remastered Sit Resist, visit dongiovannirecords.com. For more info on Better Yet, visit betteryetpod.com.